Selling book Reading Lolita in Tehran was about defying the repressive government of the Ayatollah by teaching forbidden books and about the country's lively intellectual life that was often hidden from view. Nafisi's new book, The Republic of Imagination, is about the value of fiction in a democracy, more precisely about three novels written by American authors that she says explain this country's character and values. They are Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, and Carson McCullers' The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. Nafisi writes about James Baldwin's contribution in the epilogue to her book. Azar Nafisi was born in Iran, taught English there for almost two decades, and became a U.S. citizen on December 1st, 2008. And I'm very happy to say she joins us once again in our Philadelphia studio. And Azar Nafisi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It is such a pleasure and privilege to be here again at your show.
Thank you so much. You begin your book by describing this tutor that you had when you were, I think, about 7 years old, reading The Wizard of Oz, the wonderful Wizard of Oz to you, giving it to you in little bites so that you were sort of expecting, you know, looking for her to come back and read some more. Was that your first introduction to American books?
Yes, it was my first introduction to American books. And I guess that later on, of course, I interpreted it in this way. But then America became a place where, at the heart of a place called Kansas, which was like a desert, you have a cyclone, at the heart of which there is this wondrous world. Dorothy, of course, her journey is about independence and finding out that she doesn't need to rely on the power of the wizard. She is the wizard, you know. So that was
an important message.
That was the America I imagined.
You also describe your father taking you hand in hand to the movies as a little girl. And it sounds like he took you to a lot of musicals. We all dance in this country, right?
Well, you know, Thursday nights, our weekends were on Fridays, and Thursday nights were our special nights. He would take me for a ham or sausage sandwich, and then we would walk down the streets and go to movies. And through books and movies, the world came to me. You know, we would watch from Egyptian and Indian movies to French, Italian, and Americans. But the Americans, like South Pacific or Danny Kaye, they always surprised me, because in the middle of eating meals, they all of a sudden would burst into songs and then go back to their knives and spoons, you know. So America was this sort of Wizard of Oz-ish magical place where anything was possible.
So sorry to disappoint you.
Well, the literature and the art never disappointed.
Tell us about this Republic of Imagination that you write about. How do you conceive of this republic?
Well, to put it sort of succinctly, summarizing it, I imagine it as a community of readers that don't belong to any specific country, that sort of their existence and their community transcends nationality, ethnicity, religion, race, and gender. And they come from all times. And these readers, through their curiosity to know the world and to know the stranger even within themselves, constantly are connected to one another and constantly add to our knowledge and celebration of the world. That is how I see.
Well, I was thinking about how your, I guess, Republic of Imagination perhaps grew over the fact that as a young girl you were sent away to go to school.
Yes.
You had to sort of hide within your own country
of
Iran. Now you're an American citizen, but you've had to sort of carry this idea of country and perhaps even belonging in your head.
You know, from very early childhood, because my father, the stories he would tell me would not just be about the fabulous Iranian tales and mythology. You know, one day we'll go to Italy with Pinocchio, and next day we go to France with Little Prince, then we go to America with Charlotte's Web, you know. So the whole point is that for me, that concept stayed, that there is a portable home, which is that Republic of Imagination. It is both in your backyard, because you need to go there to get away from the habits and routines of life and look at life differently. And I can take it anywhere.
Do you think that's something that immigrants either have to do or perhaps know how to do better than people that don't that have, you know, one essential country?
Yes, I think so. Of course, people who have one essential country, they will understand that one hurricane or a war or a revolution can take everything away from them that they called home. So the concept of home seems very secure, but actual physical real home is not secure at all. What is enduring is that republic of imagination, because you carry it in your memory, and no one can take away your memory from you, and no one can take away your ideas or your imagination away from you. That is how I made my home in America later on.
You chose three, really four books in your book, Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, Carson McCullers' The Heart is a Lonely Country, and also James Baldwin's Another Country. Is there something that ties these four books together in your imagination?
Well, yes, definitely. I was, when I became a little bit frustrated with the denigration of imagination in America today, especially by our elite, the only place I could go to was its works of imagination, that imaginary map I had in my mind. And I started with 24 authors, but it was impossible to
24.
Do that. Yeah, because you couldn't do them justice. And I started with Mark Twain because I think Mark Twain, as Hemingway and Fitzgerald and so many other authors say, is really the beginning of a new way of writing fiction in this country. And I feel that Huck Finn is his literary declaration of independence. We could not compete with Europe and other countries in terms of the layers of culture with Shakespeare and Molière and Dante and Ferdowsi. But Americans had something no one else had. They had something absolutely new. So their imagination could create a new man, a new woman. And that is what Mark Twain did in Huckleberry Finn. He created a new landscape and a new perspective for all of us.
It's interesting because you seem, you like Huck Finn more than you like Tom Sawyer. And
oh,
it sounds
yes.
like to you, Tom Sawyer is kind of conventional and boring.
Conventional and boring. And like all conventional and boring people, especially when they intellectualize things, you know, he thinks of himself so original, you know. And he's constantly trying to impose his own ideas. He doesn't even know the meaning of the words he used, like ransom, for example. And Huck is so intelligent and so reflective. He says, you know, all the stuff Tom was saying was just Sunday school stuff, you know. And I got my cue from Huck.
Ah, interesting.
That Tom Sawyer is really conventional. He doesn't see it. Look at the way he treats Jim. A despicable person in many ways. I'm sorry I don't have to talk like that about
a
child in a book. But, you know.
Well, books can do that to us. But what you have done in your sort of exploration of Huckleberry Finn is to also tell the story of a dear friend of yours,
yes.
a woman named Farah, also from
yes.
Iran, and how this book between the two of you was something that you shared together, something very powerful and very intimate.
Yes, yes. I first wrote this chapter without any of my own memories, and when I read it, it was rather dry and heartless. And Farah kept coming to my mind. She was an amazing woman. Well, people have to read about her if they want to find out. But at the time when I was writing Huck, she had cancer, terminal cancer. But she was such a resilient person, and she loved life. She resisted the absoluteness of death and the fickleness of life with her resilience, you know. And she fell in love with Huck. But she at that time was also in love with American history. And she kept goading me. She said, Azar, if you want to read Huck Finn, you have to read Joseph J. Ellis's Founding Brothers. You know, did you read this? Did you read that? And so we started reading together both Huck Finn and these books and trying to define if we are going to be Americans, what kind of Americans we want to be.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section of what Huck meant to both you and to Farah.
Okay, this is her last year of life. Throughout that dreadful year, the original Huck was our guide, our inspiration, the thorn in our side who reminded us to be true to ourselves and who goaded us when we became too complacent, too conventional in our preoccupations, whenever we seemed too comfortable with our lot. He gave us vital clues as to the kind of Americans we wanted to be. He reminded us, and this was something I kept coming back to, that at their best, American heroes are wary of being over-civilized, that they carve out their own path and look to their heart for what is right and just. How far we seemed to be, I would confide complicitly to Farah, from that America, the one we had both discovered so many years ago when we first read Huckleberry Finn.
Mm, and that's Azar Nafisi reading from her new book called The Republic of Imagination, America and in Three Books. Huck is also a bit of a mongrel, if I can say,
yes.
An outcast.
Yes.
And it seems that represents a lot to you. That means something very powerful to you.
Actually, you ask the reason I chose these books. One reason was that I wanted to choose the outcasts because the characters, the heroes of best American fiction are usually homeless and restless. You know, they're constantly looking towards new horizons, something that we are not doing very well today. And would Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain has this beautiful tongue-in-cheek speech, not just against the European ancestors, but against what he calls the Mayflower tribe. And he says, "You deprived me of all my ancestors," beginning with the Native Americans going through Quakers, the witches, and ending with the slave. And he says, "For I am a many-shaded, exquisite mongrel."
Mm.
You know, and I think that is the best thing about America. And Huck is the best thing about America. He turns everything that is respectable and defined and conventional on its head. He reverses all these words and gives us a new insight into what the world should be. And he's only a little boy.
And he's only, oftentimes out of the mouths of babes, right?
Yes, yes.
But even looking at these other books as well, and even other American writers, you describe America, the sort of creative Americans, as having or being perhaps the moral voice of the country.
Definitely, definitely. All fiction is moral, in essence.
Good fiction,
All great fiction, yes. And the others are very dictatorship. They impose their voice on everyone else. But great fiction is, in essence, democratic, because it is about giving voice to everyone, even the villain. And at the same time, like Huck, there is the issue of individual choice and individual independence of mind. And once Huck meets Jim, he's resurrected through Jim's eyes, and his relationship with Jim turns him at each step into a more moral person, till at the end he believes he might go to hell if he give up Jim. But he says, "I rather go to hell," and he says, "My heart was doing the wrong thing against my conscience. I just told myself, I go to hell, but I will save Jim." And that relationship between Jim and Huck is essential in Mark Twain and essential in American society, because the issue of race is accepting the other person as an individual like yourself.
And that's Azar Nafisi, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Chances are you read her book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, that came out more than a decade ago. And she has a new book called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. We've been talking a lot about Huckleberry Finn. Stay with us. Call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Yale School, serving students on the autism spectrum, announces the opening of its Philadelphia campus. Yale School is hosting a Science Night open house on October 30th. Registration online at yaleschoolpa.com.
Did you grow up in a chaotic household or live with someone who abused drugs or alcohol? Over 60% of Americans grow up experiencing some type of household dysfunction, abuse, or neglect. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness supports WHYY and is seeking menopausal women between the ages of 48 and 60 who experienced a stressful or chaotic childhood to participate in a study examining how early life stress affects memory later in life. Study participation includes brain imaging, blood draws, and memory tests. More information by contacting Claudia at 215-41-STUDY.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY and presents William Glackens, the first major exhibition of this Philadelphia-born artist in 50 years, opening November 8th with over 90 of Glackens' work, showcasing the breadth and spirit of a local artist who became America's tastemaker in modern art. On First Friday, November 7th, a vaudeville-themed opening party will celebrate Glackens' exhibition with cocktails, jazz, and circus performances. For tickets, barnesfoundation.org or 215-278-7200.
I'm Jerry McGinnis, Managing Partner for KPMG Philadelphia. Our audit, tax, and advisory professionals are passionate about turning knowledge into value to benefit our clients and the capital markets we serve. More at kpmg.com. KPMG supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Azar Nafisi. She has a new book. It's called The Republic of Imagination. And in the book, she explores three books that have meant so much to her: The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Babbitt, and The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can always send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. You said you wrote this book because an Iranian man came up to you, and I'll just quote here. He said to you, these people over in, you happen to be in Seattle, these people over in Seattle don't care. They don't like to read books.
And of course, you know that Seattle is one of the cities where people...
I was going to say, that's where people actually do read
care.
Books.
But he also meant Americans as a whole. And I've heard that from my former students who are now in Washington, D.C., that they don't care, you know. This student is writing about Elizabeth Bishop in Persian.
Ah, wow. You know? But do you think... But, it, I mean, do, yeah. do you think he's right?
Well, no. True? And that question sort of haunted me because during my travels, a lot of people would say, why is it that repressed countries appreciate books? And to tell you the truth, there are contradictory feelings that I have towards it. On one hand, we're cutting funds for music, books, writing, all the things that that young man and people like him are giving their lives for. On the other hand, during these travels, Marty, it was amazing. Red states, blue states, big cities, small cities, you have this throngs of people. There are book groups, there are students, there are young people. All of them come because they love books.
Yes.
You know, and I've connected to so many people in this country because of books. So I had to write this book partly for Ramin, for this young man, to tell him there's another side and we need to connect to that side and unite with that side.
This is such a cliche, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is that when you think about poets or poetry,
yes.
I mean, in this country, we mostly ignore poets.
You're right.
In other countries, sometimes poets are killed or jailed because of their poems.
Well, you notice that in every tyrannical dictatorship, the first targets are women, minorities, and culture. And writers and poets are right in the first. I mean, Stalin's Soviet Union, Hitler's Germany, where they burnt books. And in Iran, our poets and writers in Iran are treated like saints. The more the government kills them and tortures them and puts them in jail, the more they're beloved. You know, streets in Tehran and other cities are named after poets. And after the revolution, some of these poets whom to the government, the classical poets, like our epic poet Ferdowsi or Khayyam, who's an agnostic, you know, all of them, they wanted to change the names. That was one thing they couldn't do. So in the end, it was the government who had to praise the poets because the people would not allow it. Look at Ireland when Seamus Heaney died. The kind of homage they paid. We should have monuments to our poets.
But why do you think we don't? I mean, you've thought about language and literature,
yes,
and reading and writing and all of that. Why don't we?
Of course, I noticed in Washington, D.C., my hometown, that we have monuments to many great people, many great men, just recently to Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass as well. They weren't there before. No women, by the way.
Oh, no, interesting. Really?
No Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Susan B. Anthony, you know, so not just poets. There are others there, too. But that is what worried me, because I think the concept of America is so poetic. Those people with their monuments like Lincoln and Jefferson, their prose resonates with lyricism. I think that our elite in this country have lost that passion that used to be in this country for poetry.
You're a new citizen here, but do you worry about this country?
I worry about this country because I feel, you know, Jefferson talks about the fact that more people pay attention to building bridges than to literature and humanities. But he says we need bridges, we need engineers, but we also need the other side. And they were very careful about the fact that this country is lucky because it's built on the idea of enlightenment. That, as Washington said, you need to have both literature and science in order to ensure that happiness of a society. And all of this was supposed to be done mainly through public education. Public education, you know, not private, not charter schools, public, you know. And so I worry, what will happen to a democracy if we lose the ideas that built that democracy? If our children don't understand they should go to school not only to make money, but because of passion and meaning. If we segregate the passion for science from the passion for humanities, yes, these things really worry me.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Azar Nafisi, again, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about a whole host of things that often happens when she's a guest on the show, and she does have a new book called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. You can join us by calling 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. You taught Huckleberry Finn. I mean, that was one of the books that you taught.
It was the first book.
When you were teaching in Iran. And
yes.
Did the students there understand this book the way you do now?
The focus, because of the repression, was also on the respectable society and the smothery towns
that Huck Finn.
And we talked about this concept that wilderness, which is supposed to be not safe, is the safe place for Huck and Jim, while those civilized towns are where the danger lies and the violence. My students understood well how conformity breeds violence. Something that we do not understand here, because Huck Finn, Babbitt, Carson McCullers, and Baldwin are all against conformity in their own ways, but they also, their heart broke for Jim. You know,
that and perhaps was, identified with him.
They identified with him, and especially when a totalitarian society strips you of your individuality, you know, you become the enemy, and so you can be killed. And when I would talk up to them about the fact that Huck empathizes with Jim because a father should not be separated from his children, that is how Mark Twain criticizes racism, not through rants, you know. And they understood that very well because their individuality was being stripped as well.
As you said, you included Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, which you describe as a novel about anxiety.
Yes, isn't it?
I never thought of it that way. And to be honest with you, I have to go back and reread it.
It is partly, you know, Babbitt, actually, to tell you the truth, this time when I read Babbitt, it had a few surprises for me. One surprise was that I was partly a Babbitt. That we laugh at Babbitt and say they, but my God, we're in love with gadgets. We queue up at the Apple store, you know, and gadgets have their good side. The problem with us is not to let them control us. For us to control them, we shouldn't be against them. But the second thing was that Babbitt, who is the epitome of standardized thought, that is what he's criticized for, also dreams.
Yeah. In fact, the book opens, he's dreaming.
He's dreaming. And he, deep down in his heart, he's unhappy. He knows that he's missing his life. But he's going to conform because freedom is an ordeal. And because freedom has a price to pay and it is much easier to conform than not, he finally gives in. But the lesson is that the Babbitts of this world are human too.
A surprise to you?
A surprise to me. Because during my student years...
We judge him, right?
Yeah. But during my student years, you know, I was young and I was, you know, anti-everything. And I thought, oh, yeah, Babbitt, yeah, he's horrible. But I myself was very ideological. I was also conforming to a group, you know. So Babbitt reminds us, but he also reminds us that the danger in this country is indifference and sleeping consciousness, which conformity brings with it.
Indifference meaning not paying attention, not caring.
Not caring. And that is what if we do, you know, Ray Bradbury says that you don't need, as in Iran or other places, you don't need to burn books to destroy a culture. All you get to do is to get the people not to read them.
Ouch.
You know, and indifference is the worst enemy in this country.
Let me get, it looks like Keith from South Jersey to join our conversation. Keith, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Morning.
And hello to your guest, who has had some good perspectives to offer on a couple of things, among others, the difference between classrooms under governments of tyranny and societies that are relatively open, such as ours. And you've mentioned different kinds of repression in the past couple of minutes. We've been seeing news lately about school boards in this country that are trying their best to remove discussion and reading amongst our students about the great tradition of dissent in this mm-hmm. country, and instead have been playing up the flag waving and the patriotism and things of that nature. The students have shouted those efforts down in many cases, but I'm interested in your guest's perspective,
sure.
not just the difference between the United States and Iran, but the difference between one town and another in this country. In terms of what should be open to students and what she sees of these, what you might term repressive movements.
Keith, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Azar, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Keith.
Keith, yes.
One of the reasons I chose these books was because each of them are a warning to us that in a democracy, in an open society, the same kind of things could happen to you that happen in other places. In a sense, totalitarian societies become distorted mirrors of both the best and the worst that a democratic society has. We have banned book weeks.
We do. In fact, Huckleberry Finn has been on
and,
that
and
list.
Huckleberry Finn and many of, and in schools now, we become very politically correct, and we ban Diane Ravitch's great book, Language Police, discusses all of this. So that is one reason I wrote this book, that don't think that it always happens somewhere else. As Sinclair Lewis's one title of his book, It Can't Happen Here, it can happen here, and as democratic citizens, we need to know our civic duties and to voice what we believe is the right thing to do.
Do you think, though, and I hear this embedded in Keith's question, I mean, that all books should be read by all children, no matter their age, or... So I guess sort of how open are you to people being open to literature?
Well, I think that people should be open to literature and people should choose quality books, books that bring to us the ambiguity and the complexity of life. And look at the great fairy tales or children's stories. I mean, Charlotte's Web, for example, you know, teaches you empathy in the first paragraph, you know, and the way that people can connect and individualism at its best. You rebel, but you don't rebel for rebellion's sake, or you don't rebel because it's a dog-eat-dog world and I want to, you know, I'm the cowboy in town. You rebel because you want to connect and do the right thing. This is what our children should be taught, and at every age, there are great books. And I disagree with preaching to children and choosing stories that are only didactic, rather than we should respect the readers.
What? And speaking of fairy tales, I remember when my son was very little and I would read him all those fairy tales. I I was shocked at how violent they were, but obviously how engrossing at the same time.
Yes, I mean, remember Hansel and Gretel, whose father takes them to the dark jungle, and then there's the witch. Children are very resilient, and they instinctively catch things. Hansel and Gretel is teaching children that you will be going into a dark world, but you have inner powers to come back and then come back and help your parents. You know, we are depriving our children of all that.
Let me talk to you about Common Core, because that's another thing that you have, you sort of embedded, but it's, you do not like Common Core. Why not?
Well, first of all, I have to make it very clear that I do not oppose change in our system of education. I do think we need change. And I think we need change with changing times. There's new technology, there's a new ideas, new world. And so that is not what, and nor do I object to critical thinking. But I don't understand what Common Core means by critical thinking. Because one is the process they went through in order to come to the Common Core standards, which they somehow bragged, I mentioned in my book, that people who were doing formulating the standards were not among the educators. You know,
well, it was governors.
It was governors
and business people.
And business people, and one very big philanthropist, Bill Gates,
right.
and his foundation, and Mr. Coleman himself brags about the fact that we were not qualified in the sense that people talk about qualification. So why not? And then he talks about evidence based. You know, evidence should be based in a context. Evidence in and of itself means nothing. When you bring people with teaching experience into the conversation, first of all, you don't make them hostile and leave them out. And second of all, they bring context to the evidence. Now, they didn't bring context to the evidence of the process, and they're not doing in terms of the standards. Children need their minds to be expanded and deal with ambiguity. It wasn't reading too much fiction that made our children illiterate. Definitely, if children could read The Little Prince, they were literate. And fictional texts, you can draw amazingly critically analytical ideas from them.
But it does require a gifted teacher, I think, in some ways. I mean, some of this literature speaks for itself, but nonetheless, someone who can guide children through that. And as we know, and from our own partly personal experiences, there are good teachers and there are not so good teachers.
You are right. And I think that the issue with teachers' unions and everything should be addressed. But we have to remember one thing. I learned that through my young children who both went to a good public school. And my daughter is so adamant that if she ever has children, she wants to send her children to a public school. And my new son-in-law, who talked about that in the same place, he went to a public school, but it was very poor. And he said, the difference between your children's public school and our public school was that the good teachers were overworked and underpaid, and at some point they moved on. That there wasn't enough funding for music and art and poetry in our school. So we need to create good funding, and then we need to keep the teachers and the principals responsible. But help them, before you denigrate them. And before you take over, the way it has been done.
You had some good teachers in your life?
Yes. I had good teachers. I had teachers who were passionate. I had teachers who made me connect to the book before they imposed their own ideas on me, which is what I'm trying to do with my students. I owe a great deal to that first teacher in Iran who read Wizard of Oz to me, and we do need good teachers, but we need to respect teachers. We need to, when we talk about vocation, we need to think of teaching as the highest vocation, not the lowest.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Azar Nafisi, and she has a new book called The Republic of Imagination, and it's subtitled America in Three Books. You probably, if you didn't read, you certainly read about her book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, that came out about 10 years ago about living in Iran under that repressive regime, and the fact that she was able to teach some of these forbidden books in her own house, also a way of understanding this that country's very lively intellectual life. We're going to take a very short break. Get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about Carson McCullers and The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, Philadelphia, supports WHYY and presents Open House October 25th. The accredited professional program curriculum comes to life during live model painting demonstrations by award-winning instructors. Opportunity for private tours of on-site faculty studios, time to talk with students, instructors, and alumni who are working in the arts, and information about the new Integrated Art Studio major available with Chestnut Hill College. StudioIncaminati.org.
The Catholic Foundation of Greater Philadelphia supports WHYY. The Catholic Foundation helps support the needs of the entire community with its Helping Hands Fund. The fund works to find new approaches to feed the hungry, shelter the homeless, and bring new opportunities to those who are struggling. More information is available at 215-587-5650 or online at catholicfoundationphila.org. 215-587-5650 or catholicfoundationphila.org.
Westtown School supports WHYY. A revered Quaker school in Westchester, Westtown has modified its boarding policy, so now students who enroll in 7th grade or earlier have the choice to participate in the residential program during their high school years. Learn more about the policy and about Westtown's acclaimed programs by attending their pre-K through 12th grade open house on Sunday, November 2nd at 1 p.m. Details at westtown.edu. Boarding at Westtown. It's now up to you.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Azar Nafisi about her new book, The Republic of Imagination. Her previous books include Reading Lolita in Tehran, Things I Have Been Silent About, a memoir about growing up in Tehran and about, I would say, a difficult family life that you had there. She was born in Iran, taught English there for, almost 20 years. She's now a fellow at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and she became a U.S. citizen on December 1st, 2008. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9400. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio. Oh, no, a tweet at Marty Moss-Cohen. I forgot my own name there. That happens sometimes. I do want to talk about Carson McCullers' The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, a book I remember reading, although reading your book, I have to go back and reread it. One of the things that Carson McCullers says, and this really picks up on what we were talking about, indifference is among life's worst punishments.
Yes, that is beautiful.
It is, and yes. Poignant and sad.
I have to write that down.
Okay.
No, that is very true. And, of course, her characters in Heart is a Lonely Hunter, what they suffer most is from the world's indifference because each of them has a passion. But they cannot articulate that passion and the world is not paying attention to it. You know, and so they become isolated and almost violent. I mean, there is an undertone of violence throughout the book when you only talk to yourself, you know. And so they, you know, you talk to a deaf mute.
Who, in fact, it was called The Mute. That was the original title.
Yes, it was the Mute. And it is an amazing metaphor. I mean, from the very start with the character of Singer as the deaf mute, you realize you're dealing with the kind of characters whom the world is indifferent to. And it breeds violence. It breeds isolation. But with Carson McCullers, there's this glimmer of hope. At the end, when these characters by force have to be separated from Singer, there's no one left to listen to them, and they have to do something for themselves. And the fact that they have passion, because Carson McCullers says that her characters have something to give. Because they have this passion, there's hope for them to connect to the world.
You know? You write about, and I was actually surprised to read about her marriage, I guess. This would be Carson McCullers' marriage. Her husband, I mean, she apparently fell in love with him. He was a gorgeous-looking man, fell in love with him, but a very tragic relationship.
A very tragic relationship. And he was, as you say, very handsome. Carson McCullers was not good looking. She was so quirky looking, which makes up for everything.
It does. It helps.
But he was also he had writerly ambitions. But from the very start, it was Carson's life and Carson's writing that dominated. And the more famous she became, the less space he had to express himself. He became a drunk, and you know, they constantly had fights. They divorced, remarried. And at the end, he wanted the two of them to commit suicide together.
Yeah, a suicide pact he had for them.
Yes, yes. And she escaped him. She escaped and left him and never talked to him again. And very shortly later, he hanged himself, and he wrote her a telegram saying, going west.
Which was a sort of a metaphor,
yeah, in World War One, when they were going to die, they would say going west. He said going west, the trunk's packed.
Wow. Richard Wright, you include this, wrote to, I guess, Carson
yes.
McCullers, comparing her writing to Faulkner, and also about The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. He says, an astonishing humanity that enables a white writer for the first time in Southern fiction to handle Negro characters with as much ease and justice as those of her own race.
It is really amazing. And you know, and we realize that Carson was only 22 years old when that book was published. The amount of insight this woman had into the mind of her characters. And you know, I love what Richard Wright says, because we respect others not when we just write about ourselves or we are philanthropically talking about them. We respect others when we can go under their skin and become them. And that is what Carson did. I think African Americans should write about whites, or Chinese, or whites should write about African Americans. Iranians should write about French should write about English. That is what writing and reading is all about. That is the democracy within it. And I had to have that there, because then James Baldwin wrote about
epilogue.
A white man.
That's right. That's right. And talked about the exquisite mongrel.
Yes. He is the exquisite mongrel himself. And his first book, Go Tell It on Mountain, got so much accolade, but as a Negro book, you know. I feel that he should have gotten the Great American Book novel title along with J.D. Salinger's. But the point with him is that they told him not to publish his second book, which was about a gay white man. And he said, you know, he used a word to his publisher, an agent who told him burn the book, and said, I will publish it, you know. And he put himself in place of a young white male, you know.
Have you always been passionate about reading and writing and literature and books?
As far as I can remember, that has been what excited me. And later I realized that is my genuine home. I have no other home. I mean, I have a home in reality. I had a home in Iran, and now I have a home here. But I cannot live without that other home in any home.
So are you reading all the time? Is your, you know, next to your bed, that question about
yes.
what are the books that are next to your bedstand? I always wonder how many people actually have bedstands, but nonetheless.
Yes, people do have bedstands, apparently. I started with this book, Loving American History, a great deal. So a book on James and Abigail Adams but I also love mystery. So Ian Rankin is also by my bedside, and I'm waiting for Tana French to get her. I'm very promiscuous about reading. I love from Faulkner and Rushdie to Chandler and Tana French.
Do you watch TV?
Yeah, I do watch TV. I have to put in a pitch. I love PBS.
Okay.
And I watch not just PBS helped me a great deal with the documentaries about American history, from Civil War to this, and their American masters, Baldwin, Twain, all of those. But I also watch their mysteries, especially British mysteries, Inspector Morse, and all
I know
of
what
them.
You're talking about.
But
yes.
I love the sitcoms as well. Mm. I watch Modern Family. I love. I wish one day I could be on The Simpsons.
You could be a voice on The Simpsons.
Oh, that is really...
I think you and a lot of other people would like to have just a tiny a lot little of people, bit part.
Yes, but we're participating in it, so I think that's okay. And 60 Minutes, obviously, right. Sunday morning, CBS, and all of those, too.
Let me get Susan from Northeast Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Wonderful program.
Thank you.
As someone who's in a couple of book clubs, I'd like to remind everybody how wonderful it is to reread books that you read in high school, because now that you're older, you get a whole new take on them and understand them in a way you didn't understand them when you were 17 years old.
Fair enough, and you're nodding your head vigorously.
That is fantastic. Actually, I one of the things that I discovered after writing my books was book groups, and that shows people's real passion. You know, you connect through books, and I agree. I couldn't agree more with Susan. A book is like a great city. Every time you go into a book, you find a nook and cranny that you hadn't seen, and what better way to share it? But you know, Susan, I think we should. As book groups, we should also start uniting and working in our communities towards keeping our bookstores and libraries going. I think book groups now have a civic duty almost to keep reading going.
Well, I think put a coffee machine in there and you know, chances are you can get people to come back to the library, don't you think? I mean, you look at coffee shops and they're just filled with people, generally on their devices.
Books should be about connection, people in public spaces as well as in private. It is a private affair reading, but it is also a public, you know, way of connecting.
You became an American citizen. I have the date here, December 1st, 2008. Yes. You write about this. What did that mean to you? I mean, you had been living in this country for some time.
Yeah, I had lived for 11 years. I mention it in the book that, you know, you call a place home when you start grumbling about it. You know, because if it is not home, people come and go and they're guests in your house. They say, oh, it's nicer than our house or it's more horrible than our house. But when you love it, you don't like the way things are going. You're very meticulous about what you love. And when I started complaining, I thought I should become an American. And my motto as a good American is what Twain says. He says, patriotism is supporting your country all the time and your government when it deserves it. So that is how the kind of American I want to be.
And I wonder, too, having grown up under this, you know, first the Shah and then the repressive regime of the Ayatollah, are you suspicious of government?
I'm suspicious.
Even I know that you voted for the first time in this country.
Yes, but I'm suspicious of power. And I think that the founders were suspicious of power. You remember that also George Washington was saying that public officials should not get paid because money corrupts, you know. And I think that it is not because policymakers are bad people. It is because we need a system of check and balances, not just on the government side, but public. The first words of Constitution is we the people, and I take those first words very seriously, and I think if anything happens in this country that is not good, we the people are as responsible as the people we elected.
You voted for the first time. You voted for Barack Obama to be president of the United States. We were talking about this before going on the air.
Yes.
And if you don't mind, if we could talk publicly about that, what are your disappointments? Because it's clear there are some.
Well, yes, I voted for him also because I thought that it was not only to his credit, but the credit of the American people, what happened in this country when Clinton and Obama were running. I was in this country at the end of 70s, and things were not the way they are now. So that is the great hurrah. I had hoped that, I won't be able to talk about all my criticism, but I had hoped that Obama, who is anyway accused of being both a socialist and a capitalist, elite and all sorts of things, you know, that he would pay more attention to people who actually voted for him, who are people of imagination and people of ideas, that he more than anyone else would understand understand the relationship between humanities and science. He would remember when Einstein said that I love imagination even more than knowledge, because knowledge is limited, but imagination encircles the world. You know, and I worry about the present. I support him when he tries to help the public schools and help strike the poverty-stricken areas, and I understand all the obstacles in his way, he inherited, and the whole world the way it is now. I understand all that and empathize, but I still think that our public education deserves a better program than what we have now, especially because his own children go to a school that does not follow the Common Core.
When was the last time you were in Iran?
When I left Iran, which was in 1997.
Wow.
And I'm almost in Iran every day, in a sense, but
in your imagination.
In my imagination, but 1997, yes.
Do you follow, though, Iranian politics and this, you know, this Rouhani and all of that? And does that engage you?
More than the politics, what engages me is Iranian people. And you know, it is really amazing. I don't want to exaggerate these things, you know, and generalize them, but it is amazing that these people for 30-something years have resisted. They have resisted ordinary people. I'm not talking about the heroes who are right now in jail. You know that four women just had acid thrown into their faces in the city of Isfahan for not wearing the veil properly. I think that Iran's civil society has been so strong that more and more people defect from the government to join the people rather than the other way around. And with Mr. Rouhani, you know, the proof of the
pudding?
Pudding is in eating it. So I would believe him when I see changes. I'm not talking about the diplomatic negotiations about about nuclear power. What I'm thinking is that my judgment is only based on the well-being of Iranian people. If he does something for that, I would give him credit. Right now, I have more questions.
What are you reading right now?
Well,
or perhaps how many books are you reading right now, right?
Yes, actually, there are quite a few. I am also taking a break from fiction and reading some poetry. I'm reading Merwin.
Oh, W.S. Merwin.
What a man. What a poet, not a man, poet. And I went back to some of my favorites, like actually Elizabeth Bishop and Sylvia Plath. And just yesterday I was at this marvelous bookstore in Connecticut, R.J. Williams, and I got a new collected works of Auden, whom I love. And I'm also reading Ian Rankin. So, you know.
You're very busy.
I'm very busy. I'm very busy.
Always a pleasure.
And Marilynne Robinson's Leela, I got it. I haven't read it yet. It's in my, you know.
Well, always a pleasure, Azar Nafisi, to have you on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
I so much appreciate you, Marty. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, the book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out about how to find us on Twitter and Facebook, satellite radio, and how to download a podcast. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.